My name is Michael Waldman. I am the president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, and we are delighted to welcome you to this evening's presentation and this conversation about the lessons of Watergate for the Trump era, a topic of great interest to so many of us. For those of you who don't know, the Brennan Center for Justice here at NYU School of Law is a nonpartisan law and policy institute devoted to reforming and revitalizing and, when necessary, defending the systems of democracy and justice in the United States. We work on voting rights. We work on corruption and money in politics. We work for criminal justice reform. Just this morning, a number of us were in Washington, D.C., where a law enforcement gathering of police chiefs and prosecutors said we can and should have criminal justice reform and a reversion to the war on drugs and discarded and disguised policies is not a good idea. We work on civil liberties, and in all these ways, we work to make the values of our Constitution real in this moment. The Brennan Center was founded by the clerks and family of the late Justice William Brennan, and we take our spirit from him, his vision that human dignity is at the center of the law, and his vision that the Constitution has to be something that comes alive for the challenges of each new time and each new generation. As I said, we focus on systems, on the way decisions get made, the way self-governance works in the United States. We believe, especially now, that if you want to solve the problems, you have to fix the systems. We believe that our systems of democracy, the systems by which we have stayed free for over two centuries, are badly broken, are corroded, that the challenges we see right now are a symptom, and Donald Trump and the challenges he poses are a symptom of the broken aspects of our democracy. But this is not the only time in our country's history when those systems have been at risk. We feel every day in the work we do, in the lawsuits we bring, in the legislation we write, in the studies we compile, that we're part of, right now in 2017, a great fight for the future of liberal democracy in the United States. And we all know that this is a fight that's going on not just in our country but around the world. But that is not a fight that began now, and it's not a fight that only happened now. Think about this. It was 44 years ago, 2 days from now, Friday, that President Richard Nixon fired Archibald Cox, the Watergate special prosecutor. And as you know, the Attorney General of the United States resigned. His deputy resigned. It was a little confusing who was fired and who resigned, but they were out. This was the famous Saturday Night Massacre. Archibald Cox that day, the special prosecutor who was investigating President Richard Nixon, said in an eloquent statement at the time that it is now the question facing the country is whether ours will be a government of men or laws. And that will be up to the Congress and the public. That led to a firestorm, as the White House Chief of Staff, Alexander Haig, called it, a response to the firing, to the Saturday Night Massacre, that was so intense that at that moment the president relented on a number of the issues. And in a way, it was the midpoint of the Watergate scandal and the Watergate constitutional crisis. And we, working on issues today of constitutional self-governance, and all of us living through this unnerving moment in American history, find ourselves drawn inexorably to the lessons of that time, to the facts, to the legal issues, to the tough questions about how we can govern ourselves. Now, for a lot of people, certainly the folks on stage with me, they lived through this as participants, as key and central participants. Many people lived through that time as observers, as citizens. I was 13 years old during that period. I even happened to be in the gallery of the House of Representatives the day, coincidentally, on a summer vacation that the pivotal smoking gun tape was released, and saw the scene there in the pre-C-SPAN era when members of Congress reacted to things like that by jumping up and down and cheering, which they probably wouldn't do today. But for many people, and many people at the Brennan Center, many brilliant lawyers and brilliant scholars, Watergate is not just something they maybe studied in school, it's something they've only heard vague whispers of. They see it on Rachel Maddow every once in a while, or on Chris Hayes, but they really don't know what it was and what the lessons might be and what we can learn from it. And so we thought that it was important to ask those questions and to draw some of those lessons. And we are extraordinarily fortunate to have with us two of the central figures from that time in American history who've been active to this day in thinking about these questions to help us understand. The first person I'm going to introduce immediately to my right is John Dean. John Dean served as counsel, the White House counsel, to President Richard Nixon beginning at 32 years old. He was, as is well known, involved in a central way in the cover-up of the Watergate break-in and the Watergate cover-up. And then in the spring of 1973, came to broad public attention when he testified before the Senate Watergate Committee and told the country and the world about President Nixon's involvement in those illegal activities, and really broke open that scandal in a very significant way for the country. He pleaded guilty and served time, and since then has been a business person and a prominent and articulate voice on these issues. He's authored numerous books, most recent one of which is called The Nixon Defense, which is an extraordinary volume looking at a whole host of new documents and new tapes to understand what really went on. He is a commentator for CNN, a columnist for Justia, if I'm getting that right, engaged in teaching about these issues all across the country. And thank you so much for being here, John Dean. And to John Dean's right is somebody who is known to so many of us here in New York City, who has been a leader in our city for so many years, Elizabeth Holtzman. Liz Holtzman was elected to Congress as the youngest woman elected to Congress in 43 years. She defeated the chair of the House Judiciary Committee in a Democratic primary in 1972. She was, we believe, the youngest member of the House Judiciary Committee. I've checked and found nobody else that I could identify during the impeachment proceedings against President Richard Nixon. She was a powerful voice. She was a powerful voice a month after the resignation of President Nixon and after the pardon of President Nixon by the new president, Gerald Ford, in unprecedented hearings investigating that pardon, where the President of the United States testified and this young member of Congress in her first term asked some of the toughest questions ever asked of a president. She served in Congress. She served as comptroller of the city of New York and as the district attorney for the borough of Brooklyn, then as now the coolest borough there is in New York. She's the author of three books is a graduate of Harvard Law School, has taught here at NYU School of Law, among other things, and we are very honored to have you here, Liz Holtzman. And so I have so many questions I want to ask, and I know that there are so many questions that our audience wants to ask. And really, we're going to look first at what happened then and what we can understand about what happened then. We're going to look at the present moment, the present administration, the present scandals, and the present crises of our democracy to understand a little better what some of the issues are that we face in the Trump era, what some of the similarities might be and differences. And then we'll conclude, at least my part of the questions will conclude, by trying to look forward and ask, what is it that we can do? What is it that the system should be asked to do? What should we as citizens be doing? And then we'll have opportunity for questions from everybody. And so if I could start my questions with you, John.
Sure.
You, in some of your writing, have cited the political scientist James David Barber to talk about the personality types of presidents. And he divided presidents into their personality types, whether they were active or passive, and whether they had a positive view of things or a kind of a sour and negative view of things. And you've said that you think that Richard Nixon, as well as Donald Trump, are both active and negative, and that this was really quite important. Other scholars have looked at the same set of people and concluded that structural questions are more important. I think you know, I worked for President Clinton as one of his senior aides in the White House for 7 years. I was his chief speechwriter. And we were very taken by a book by a political scientist named Stephen Skoronek called The Politics That Presidents Make. And he looked at President Nixon and thought that above all else, his troubles were driven by the fact that he was a minority president and in a sense had won in a three-way race and had Congress controlled by the other party. You've really looked more at the personal questions. What do you think, how important was his personality to what happened, any president's personality to what happens in a White House, and how did it play out in Watergate?
First of all, I'd like to preface my remarks. When I came in the room and came up to the stage, I noticed there was a piano up here. And I just want everyone to know, I only sing in front of Senate committees. So that they will not roll that piano out tonight. But I'll be happy to address all your questions and the audience questions. Looking at, I was struck by Barber's work years ago and sort of had a tradition in my columns, which started with Fine Law and then with Justia for the last, 15, 16 years, of taking the Barber test and seeing how the incumbent president came out on his scaling, where he has these quadrants he puts presidents in, and they seem to bear out. And I was struck when I found that both Nixon and Trump are what he calls active negative, meaning they get into their job, they don't like and don't have any self-satisfaction in the job they're doing. And that was certainly true of Nixon. He didn't like a lot of the things he had to do, whereas the man you worked for just thrived on crowds, thrived on the job, worked that job to literally the last minute he could work it. So I think we have two very different men, but the Barber test sort of supersedes that. I think with Nixon, you might have had one of the most qualified people to ever become president. If you think about it, he was in the House, he was in the Senate, he served as vice president. He actually was acting president for a while during the Eisenhower heart operation, so he actually felt the full weight of the office. So when he arrived there, he certainly had the qualifications to handle the job. What he did with the job is something else. And I think right now with Trump, we have probably the least qualified man who's ever fulfilled that post. I don't sense that Mr. Trump has even a very good newspaper knowledge of the job. it's worrisome to me that he doesn't understand the job and what he might confront. But it also worries me even more once he understands the job and knows what those different levers and buttons do. And we can get into that as the evening goes on. But I think that they're very different personalities. I'm surprised they came out really in the same place that Barber would put them. And these are typically failed presidencies that are active negatives. So Trump has done a pretty good job of showing that he's headed down that path right now so far.
They're getting the next paperback edition ready of the book, perhaps.
It'd be wise.
How did the machinery of the White House, of which you were a part, Oh, sure.
You need your mic.
I know a little professional psychologist, and I haven't read these books, but I've been in government and sometimes in leadership positions. And I'm not sure that, I'm sure obviously personality makes a big difference. It makes a big difference in terms of how the public responds to you, in terms of how you carry out your job. But if we're really talking about values here, or if we're talking about something deep, then we have to talk about character, because that's in the end what determines what a president is going to do. Because there are so many pressures. Am I going to do the right thing, or am I going to do the political thing? Am I going to do this because it's re-election is there or not? Am I going to help this person because that's going to redound to my benefit? Not good for the country, but it's good for me. Those decisions come up every single second you're in public office. So what decision are you going to make? And I think we had, in the end, with Richard Nixon, and certainly seems to be the case with Mr. Trump, that this is the issue of character is pretty central. And the ends justified the means, break-ins, misuse of power that we saw with regard to Richard Nixon. And I think with regard to Mr. Trump, the lying, the constant lying, I mean, I think John Dean says he's concerned he's the least fit person. I don't know if President Trump can tell the difference between what's true and what's not true. I don't know how his mentation works. I don't know what he can absorb. I don't know what he knows. I don't know that he could. He doesn't understand the Affordable Care Act, but I'm not even sure if somebody sat down and tried to explain it to him that he could understand it. So I think we're in a serious situation, not only in terms of character. So
you're in the Rex Tillerson camp on his mental.
Yeah, I might use a few more adjectives or adverbs. But, yeah, I think that that's a serious problem. But I think there's also the character problem.
Well, John,
I'm sorry to just interrupt.
How do you react to that question of character? And because anybody who gets into that job is some mix of dark and light and doing the right thing and doing the expedient thing. What caused Nixon? Why do you agree with what Liz Holtzman has said about character ultimately being?
I do. I think that's vital. I didn't really know Richard Nixon before I went to the White House. I assumed, as a lot of people had, that by the time he arrived there, that Tricky Dick had grown into a senior statesman, and as I said, he was certainly qualified for the job. I didn't really meet Richard Nixon until I'm there almost several years. The White House counsel's job then and pretty much now is a middle-level staff job. I didn't have direct access to the president. My predecessor, John Ehrlichman, gave up the title. He never gave up the job. As Alex Butterfield testified in front of your committee, Alex wasn't even sure the president knew who I was, and Alex didn't know that I, after just the time he was leaving in late February, March of 1973, Nixon was starting to call on me. This is some 8 months after the arrest at the Watergate, and he learns that really I am the one who is I'm reporting to Haldeman and Ehrlichman what I'm picking up from the other lawyers and from the Department of Justice where the investigation is. And so he doesn't call on me until after he's been safely reelected by an overwhelming margin. The American people don't care anything about the issue during the election. The only newspaper that's covering the story is the Washington Post. Occasionally CBS News would pick up stories from the Post, but it really was not an issue at all in the 72 campaign. So When I go in to start dealing with him, I don't know how much he knows or doesn't know. I'm not quite sure how to operate with him. But after about a half a dozen meetings, I feel pretty comfortable that he's very comfortable with me. And that's when I tell him how deep the troubles are that we're involved in, that there's a cancer on his presidency. I just don't mince any words. I think that's, is what I think is the counsel's responsibility. I have told him earlier things. For example, he didn't know, as best I could tell, and he'd later swear that he didn't know earlier, that my predecessor, Mr. Ehrlichman, had authorized a break-in in Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office after the leak of the Pentagon Papers. And the reason that becomes important, that's an event that happens in the leak of the papers in June of 71. The break-in into Ellsberg's office is in September of 71. And the reason that becomes important in June of 72 with the Watergate arrest is when Gordon Liddy confesses to me after the arrest what has gone on. He said, it's my mistake. I shouldn't have used somebody from the re-election committee. But even more importantly, you've got to understand that two of the men I used at the Watergate, I used at the Ellsberg break-in. And this is the first I learn of this incident. And I take that back to Ehrlichman, who has, I know today, literally authorized it in writing. He's given an option memo in which he literally writes, okay, so long as I have your assurance, this is not traceable to the White House.
There's a lesson right there.
There's a lesson right there, Watergate. But anyway, so when I start dealing with Nixon, he doesn't even know, best I can tell, I tell him this about my third meeting with him, because this is why the White House is concerned. Otherwise, I think they might have cut the re-election committee loose. The White House has no direct knowledge of the Watergate incident. So I'm not sure who this man is I'm dealing with. When I go in on March 21st, I really meet Richard Nixon. Mm-hmm. I make my best case as to why I hope he brings his fist down on the table and says this has got to stop.
But you view that as not only a personal moment or a moment in response to the kind of prosecutorial forces closing in, but what a White House staffer and what a counsel should do in a moment like that.
It's a combination of things. I teach a continuing legal education program where we draw from, in fact, my presentation partner is in the audience tonight. We draw from that history and say what would have happened had the model rules that the American Bar Association came out with post-Watergate been available or been the norms for lawyers during Watergate. 21 lawyers get on the wrong side of the law during Watergate. I think those rules would have influenced a lot of people. They certainly would have influenced me, and they changed a lawyer's bargaining position. Rather than Nixon brushing me off, as he did in the March 21st conversation, I would have to have told him, said, Mr. President, if you don't deal with this, I have to report this to the House Judiciary Committee or the Senate Judiciary Committee. I have to report this out under the model rules. This is a requirement of lawyers. That's a little leverage for lawyers, and it would have... Nixon would have had a much different reaction had that been the reality.
So that actually is a good pivot to the questions I have for you, Liz, because at this point, the investigations and the reaction to the investigations become the story for the next year. And you were on the House Judiciary Committee in your first term. The Watergate hearings in the Senate happened in 1973. The impeachment proceedings didn't really begin until a few months after that. It was a very different Congress in so many ways.
After Archibald Cox's firing.
After the Cox firing. Very different Congress, as partisan as it was then. When you finally took the vote, you had six Republicans voting to impeach the person from their own party who had just won 49 states less than 2 years before. How do you see the investigation unfolding from the respective history? And when we talk about Watergate, a lot of these ancillary things, such as the Ellsberg break-in, are actually some of the most significant things people talk about. And you actually supported articles of impeachment, as I understand, about the secret bombing of Cambodia. So how, talk about, you wrote it. So how, talk about how this unfolded from your perspective.
First, before I begin, I'd just like to introduce Robert Sheehan, who came down to Washington, called up. Bob, stand up so people can see you. He volunteered. He called up on the phone. He said, I'm a lawyer. I want to help out in the impeachment inquiry. And we didn't have enough people to do all the work that needed to be done. So Bob was great. And he ultimately became the managing partner of Skadden Arp. So he must have learned something from that experience, too. Anyway, I was very fortunate to have some very fine staff people with me. But first of all, let me say, I didn't want to be on the House Judiciary Committee in 1972 when I was elected, even though my predecessor had left a vacancy because I defeated him, and he was the chair of that committee. And the reason I didn't is because in November 1972, impeachment was the farthest thing in the mind of the American people and of the powers that be in Congress. Because you know that if they had an inkling that there'd be an impeachment, which would have meant the House Judiciary Committee would have been in the center of American history, I never would have been put on it. That's the best indication. Nobody knew that there was going to, that the president was connected, or that to the Watergate break-in, which took place in June. It's really, this chronology is really important. Just brief chronology. June 72, Watergate break-in. June to November 72, cover-up takes place. Congress is barred from, can't hold hearings. The press is doing some reporting. But there is really no connection to the President of the United States. Richard Nixon is elected in November with one of the largest landslides in the history of the United States. Then Judge Sirica, a very conservative Republican judge, smelled something fishy with the Watergate burglars who were arrested. And he knew there was something odd going on. And so he imposed a very stiff sentence on the burglars, 25 years, I think.
Up to 40 years.
Excuse me, up to 40. But was it a minimum of 25? There was a minimum. There was a big, it was a, believe me, they were not happy. And as a result, one of the burglars broke down and told the judge that there were higher-ups involved. And that was the beginning of the end. Because then the Senate held hearings. The Senate Watergate Committee was put together. Even though the Democrats controlled the Senate, it was largely a bipartisan committee. And they began to hold hearings. John testified. Many of the other people who were in the White House testified. Haldeman, Nixon's chief of staff, and Ehrlichman, his chief of domestic policy, and
Butterfield.
They both did at the direction of Richard Nixon. That's on the tapes too. And then what happened in the summer was that of summer of 73 was that Butterfield, who was a staff person in the White House, told the Senate Watergate Committee that that President Nixon had tape recordings of what happened in the White House. And that then became the critical factor, because it would show who's telling the truth. Is John Dean telling the truth that he told the president there was a cancer on the president on the White House, or was the President Nixon telling the truth that John Dean lied? And so the special prosecutor, I won't go into that because it's a long discussion, but a very important discussion of how we happened to get a special prosecutor. The special prosecutor said, I am investigating Watergate. I am going to get the tapes. And then when he got too close to the tapes, Richard Nixon had him fired. And because the Attorney General of the United States and the Deputy Attorney General of the United States both resigned, the country said, something's wrong here. This looks like a banana republic. We're not a banana republic. The president's not going to determine who prosecutes him or the evidence that's going to be presented. And so there was a firestorm, huge public outcry, and then Congress said, we're going to do something, the House of Representatives said. There were serious efforts, but very marginal, to start impeachment proceedings before that. Father Drinan had a resolution of on the floor of the House of Representatives because of the revelation about the fact that the president had ordered the bombing of a neutral country, Cambodia, and lied to the American people and to the Congress about it, kept two sets of books, just as they do in Brooklyn, and when I became DA, to conceal it. So I just lost my train of thought. But anyway, the impeachment started, and some people started talking, including me, some younger members and others, when we heard all the testimony. What are we doing about it here in the House of Representatives? Why aren't we doing something? But the House leadership and the leadership of the House Judiciary Committee would not budge. There was absolutely no appetite whatsoever. It was like a granite wall to do anything about impeachment, despite all the revelations that had taken place through the Senate Watergate Committee and other committee work by other committees in Congress, to do anything about impeachment until the Saturday Night Massacre and the response of the American people. And that's when the inquiry started. I mean, maybe there wasn't a formal resolution, but the work began to pick counsel, to pick staff, to start the work.
As it happens, I was the chief minority counsel of the House Judiciary Committee before Liz arrived there back in 65, 66, and some very productive years of the House Judiciary Committee, things like the Voting Rights Act, Voting Rights Act amendments, the Civil Rights Act, 25th Amendment, 18-year-old vote. Those were days that today don't even seem possible. But anyway, I'd like Liz's reaction. One of the things that I always found interesting, I worked under the chairman that she defeated, Manuel Seller, and he had a woman by the name of Bess Dick, who was really running the House Judiciary Committee. And I went to Bess one day and said, I'm curious about the impeachment files. This committee has jurisdiction over federal judges and any other impeachments. Where are the records of all that? And in essence, I learned there are no records. The House Judiciary Committee has zero capacity to investigate impeachment inquiries. They never have, and they have never had any disposition to acquire that capability. When Watergate occurred, what they really did is, while they hired additional staff, they relied on the Senate Watergate Committee and their hearings. While they had hearings, they were really kind of perfunctory in the bigger picture. They were trying to educate themselves, and it took a long time as people who came in from outside, who were some volunteers, some just worried about the committee's ability to grope with these things, coming in and working with it. It's to me one of the flaws of the system and one of the congressional flaws that the committee that has jurisdiction over impeachments has zero capacity to undertake impeachments. And that's true today, it was true yesterday. Just as a footnote.
Maybe I'm not sure I can agree with you that it has zero capacity to undertake impeachments, because the committee did vote to impeach Richard Nixon.
Well,
if Nixon hadn't resigned, the whole House would have voted to support those articles overwhelmingly, and he would have been convicted and removed in the Senate. So the committee did put together articles of impeachment and did put together a blueprint, that is a legal blueprint, for the impeachment of a president. They really did, they abused their power, and in my opinion, in the Clinton impeachment, because I didn't think there was a high crime and misdemeanor violation of the impeachment articles of the Constitution. But the committee did, I think it's safe to say, I don't know how much investigation they did, but we started out with one very important thing, which is, what does the Constitution mean? The Constitution creates a standard for impeachment. treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Well, we never studied the impeachment clause in law school. Probably, I don't know if they still, if they do, if it's studied today. What is a high, we pretty much know what treason is. It's defined in the Constitution. Bribery is a pretty well understood term. What's another high crime and misdemeanor? High crime? We don't talk that way. High misdemeanor? What is that? So we had to study that. And the committee put together a memorandum. It did a lot of research on that subject. And the other thing the committee did, which I think was very important.
That happened to be a young Yale recent graduate by the name of Hillary Clinton who did that work.
Well, you know, we didn't know who did the staff work because it was too low level for us, high, important people.
This is proof that some things do not ever change in Washington. So that's where. Well, let's.
I don't know how to finish that up. I do think the committee handled the impeachment in an extremely responsible manner. Could we have done more investigation? I thought there should have been more investigation done. But ultimately, the American people respected the work that we did, and history has borne out the fact that we did it in a responsible and fair way.
So let's take some of those high crimes and misdemeanors out for a drive and look at more recent activities. First of all, let me say this is the Brennan Center for Justice, an event and a conversation with John Dean and Elizabeth Holtzman on the lessons of Watergate for the Trump era. Those of you in the room know that, but in case anybody's listening on Facebook, that is what we're doing. And let's turn to the current moment. You've both been quite passionate and quite alarmed about what you see unfolding and the risks to our democracy that you see. John, you've said that I've seen that you think there's greater risks to our democracy than you've ever seen. Liz, you've written that collusion with Russia, if found, could be treason or another federal crime. Firing James Comey in the middle of the investigation, if it's done to stymie the Russia investigation, could be obstruction of justice. Either act could be an impeachable offense. Let's look at some of the questions we're facing right now, because, of course, in Watergate, it began, at least the public part of this story began, with arrests. And there have not been arrests. But we do know
that
a hostile foreign power intervened in our election. We do know that there's an awful lot of evidence that there was, at the very least, collusion between the campaign of Donald Trump, who the intervention was designed to help, and that hostile foreign power. We know that the chief investigator who was looking into it, the head of the FBI, was fired. And after a few days in which all this president's men and women went out and came up with a bunch of cockamamie reasons why it happened, President Trump blurted out that he did it because of, quote, the Russia thing, the Russia-Trump thing. We know that there are other issues, not just related to the Russia matter, that are of grave concern, whether it's assaults on the media and threats to go after the broadcast licenses of critical media outlets, whether it's the Emoluments Clause and other constitutional provisions. What do you see, as you look at this, as some of the main issues, starting with, let's say, obstruction of justice? That is something people ask about quite a bit. And we all know that somebody like Alan Dershowitz looks at what happened and said, well, the president has the right to do whatever he wants. And even James Comey has said, well, the president can fire an FBI director for any reason or no reason. What do you see as potentially unfolding here?
Well, first of all, I see a president who is unindictable. It's been the policy of the Department of Justice since 1973 when Spiro Agnew said when he was under investigation for bribery and tax violations that he could only be impeached and not indicted. The Department of Justice issued a formal opinion. The Office of Legal Counsel in 73 said, sorry, Mr. Agnew, you're wrong. You can be indicted, and we don't bother with impeachment because we can indict you. It's the president who can't be indicted. And that opinion was updated in 2000 during your president's administration to reaffirm it's the policy of the Department of Justice that a sitting president cannot be indicted.
Can't be too careful.
The fact that there are serious and well-reasoned dissenting opinions on that issue, just fundamentally that no president, no person in our system should be above the law, and so it's dismissed as while there are some practical problems with putting a president in trial, it theoretically could also be handled under the 25th Amendment where the vice president or others could take charge during a presidential trial. But really, impeachment is the only remedy. When I make the allusion to the fact that I'm talking about permanent capability for investigating impeachable offenses. The House Judiciary has just chosen never to set up the machinery to have that permanent, rather, it's an ad hoc situation. And no question, the model of modern presidencies is what happened under Peter Rodino as chairman when the House Judiciary Committee began the Watergate or the Nixon impeachment inquiry. But those parameters are, as I say, not permanent, but temporary.
Although in the Clinton impeachment, it was Ken Starr, the special prosecutor, who did the...
Well, that's what happened actually with Watergate as well. During Watergate, the second special prosecutor, Leon Jaworski, went to Judge Sirica, got permission to send to the House Judiciary Committee what was termed euphemistically was the roadmap that was sent up there that showed the outline of the work that was prepared by the Watergate prosecutors for the Judiciary Committee to help guide them in their own proceedings. And then, of course, in the Starr proceedings, he contrary to his ethics counsel, Sam Dash, who happened to have been chief counsel of the Senate Watergate Committee, directly referred the material from the grand jury up to the House Judiciary Committee.
Liz, from what you see, what should we be looking for in terms of obstruction of justice?
I think the issue of whether he can be prosecuted while he's president, I happen to think, agree with the point you made that no president should be above the law, and given the Supreme Court's decision that a president can be sued in civil cases,
just
I don't understand why he can't
Liz.
Be. Yeah, right. I don't think there's a constitutional
barrier.
But I think the critical thing here is not to get caught up in that question, but to understand that actually right now as we sit here, there probably is a case to be made legally under the Constitution that Donald Trump has violated the impeachment clauses and is subject to impeachment. But I think and I could go into some of the examples, but that's not really the critical question, just having the quote-unquote legal grounds. I mean, Alan Dershowitz doesn't know what he's talking about with regard to this. He was my professor at Harvard Law School, but he doesn't know what he's talking about. The fact of the matter is that and I don't know how you translate the serious abuses of power that have taken place into public demand for action, which is what happened in Watergate. As I tried to say before, despite all the revelations that had taken place before the Senate Watergate Committee, including the discovery of the tapes, the House of Representatives was not moving on impeachment. It didn't matter that the Democrats were in control and that you had a Republican president. It didn't matter. This was not even actually a partisan issue. The House of Representatives wasn't going to move. Maybe it's because of the public wasn't demanding any movement and the enormous inertia with regard to, and maybe a justifiable inertia, not to move quickly or improvidently or imprudently on impeachment. But I think that, and maybe that there's a big gap in the public's understanding here. I saw a terrible poll number today which said that 46% of the American people think that the media has been giving fake news about Donald Trump.
Politico poll.
This is really frightening because if the public doesn't well, I guess they must think it's fake, because how could this be true? How could we have anybody in the White House? I mean, that's the only silver lining here. How could we have anybody in the White House who could behave that way? So they must not be true. But the fact of the matter is, if people stop to think about the assaults that that exist on our constitutional rights and on the Constitution itself, then maybe we would have some movement. But everything is, maybe it's also being postponed because of the Mueller investigation, and people are waiting for the criminal prosecution to take place, because somehow there's this idea that you need to have a crime to have a high crime and misdemeanor. High crime and misdemeanor has nothing to do with crimes. It has to do with assaults on, it has to do with an abuse of power, an assault and subversion of our system of government, and something that could undermine people's rights. So I don't have an explanation for it, but somehow we have to mobilize, make people understand what are the potential or actual violations of the impeachment clause, and two, what they can do to get involved to try to make this happen.
Michael, I think the lesson is it takes an awful lot of inertia, takes an awful lot of public attention, and it probably takes a triggering event to start an impeachment proceeding in modern times.
The firing of...
Well, there's some triggering event.
So we are eager to open the floor to all of you for questions. We have microphones, do we have only one microphone? So folks we're not going to hear you anyway, so go to the mic if you want to ask your question.
Hi, my name is Joy Silver, and I have been trying to write, on social media to motivate people to understand the ramifications of what's happening. And I wonder if you can confirm in my mind and perhaps give us the examples that you think constitute an impeachable offense, because it seems to me that there are many that have been committed, and there are also many enablers that are allowing Donald Trump to remain in power.
Let me take a crack at that first, and then Liz can, who's been down in even deeper in the weeds than I have on this. I think, first of all, you've got to understand Gerald Ford once said, the House, in essence, a simple majority of the House can impeach anything, a ham sandwich. The example he used. It's a political decision. It's a political process that is from the Constitution. It has due process and other elements to it. It is a fair proceeding, typically, but it is. That's the old drop the mic trick. Yes, but it also. It is overwhelmingly a political decision. To get into the specifics, they often become just nothing more than political calls when you get down into the details. We all could agree on some and disagree on others. There's no question that we're in a situation where there's probably a prima facie case at this point for impeachment. What kind of detail you want to get into and how you prove it are more detail than we have time to get into.
And it's also worth noting that at no point in the country's history has a serious move for impeachment ever happened when the president's party realistically controls the Congress.
That's true, too.
Maybe not in the future, but certainly.
That's its political nature.
Is this on? Okay. Saying that it's political doesn't necessarily capture the essence of what impeachment is. Gerald Ford happened to be president of the United States, but he wasn't omniscient, and he wasn't really a legal scholar. And the fact that he said that what he said wasn't about a ham sandwich, it was just whatever the Congress wants is impeachable. That's not true. I mean, theoretically, it could be true, but members of Congress, and I think the House Judiciary Committee, at least during the Nixon impeachment process, spent a lot of time trying to understand whether the acts that Richard Nixon committed fell within the rubric of the Constitution, which is treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. And we spent a lot of time trying to figure that out, and I think we parsed that carefully, and we thought we fell within that rubric when we voted the articles for impeachment. Will other Congresses, you know, do something that's beyond the Constitution? I can't say, but just to say it's political doesn't mean that members of Congress won't act in a conscientious way about this, number one.
Thank you.
Number two, okay, but I think just to say what the potential ground, John used the right word, prima facie ground would be.
I didn't mean political in the partisan sense. I meant in the process sense. It is a political process.
Right, exactly. And so there would be potentially an argument that the president has already engaged in high crime and misdemeanor by firing James Comey and by talking about pardons. There were pardons that were talked about. That was one of the grounds of the impeachment of Richard Nixon, his offer of pardons to the burglars, not personally, but through other people. In addition, Richard Nixon fired the special prosecutor to stop an investigation of himself. That's what apparently took place. I mean, we don't know that for sure, but there's at least prima facie, you might make the argument that was why Comey was fired. If you prove that, you would have an impeachable offense. But will the country want impeachment, and would Congress be galvanized to move on it? Those are the questions. There are other areas, I won't list them all, but there are a number of other areas that could be looked at just as well as the firing of Comey.
Yes, my name is Christopher Vicciola. I'm on Congressman Jim Hines' committee. As you know, he's with Homeland Security, Cybersecurity. Also, I'm a member of the Southern Poverty Law Center, and I served as an advisor to President Barack Obama. My question is presented, can President Donald Trump fire Robert Mueller, and what will the ramifications be?
Well, he certainly has the power to do so. Not directly, he could instruct his deputy attorney general who appointed the special counsel. So theoretically, the power is there. The ramifications are the big issue. And what intent is he doing it with? Is he doing it to kill the investigation? That's where you get in the area of obstruction of justice, to block the investigation. Is he doing it for some other reason? It's hard to imagine any other reason he would do it, but theoretically, if there was a for-cause reason, he could do it with no consequence at all. I believe that's written into the regulations that were created when they retired the Independent Counsel Act. So the power is there and the ability is there, but I think the consequence and the intent would be the key questions and the key issues.
And I think we all agree that it is a fallacy, which we hear sometimes, that because something is technically or formally allowed, that means that any president can do whatever they want. I have the right to drive a car, but not to drive a getaway car. The purpose for which something like firing Mueller or something else is done is pretty critical. We want to give folks a chance for lots of questions, so go ahead.
Hi, Lindsay Tully from New York City. How did you feel when Ford pardoned Nixon back then, and how do you feel in hindsight?
I thought it was the wrong thing to do then. It created a dual standard of justice. And I still feel the same way today.
I had just pleaded guilty. It gave me an extra feel for it. Because my lawyer had given me a case where if I wanted to beat the rap, there was a way to beat the rap. But that isn't why I came forward and did the things I did. You know, at the time, I thought it was a bad precedent. It was followed by Bush 1, who would pardon people who were being investigated by an independent counsel. So it did set up a precedent, but the only president who's ever been pardoned. In the big picture, it probably was the right thing. for me, because it let the country get on. Otherwise, the Ford administration would have spent the totality of its time doing nothing but respond to document requests and deal with the. It would have dominated the news, and I think that probably Watergate, while I wasn't happy with its resolution in that regard, needed to get placed aside and move on.
I just want to, just a footnote. While the impeachment activities were going on, which took up 24/7 of our time, the House of Representatives was able to do its work, and I think the country certainly would have been able.
The House could have gone on and impeached Nixon even after he left office.
That's true.
They had the power, and they could have said, you know, here's what we're going to do, and send it over to the Senate to try him. So there is no pardon power for impeachment. That's the exception in the Constitution.
Right. But what I'm trying to say is that the country could have chewed gum and walked at the same time.
To quote President Lyndon Johnson about Gerald Ford. So we have a limited time. So what I would ask is if we could have a lightning round of, if you could ask the first three people ask your questions, and we'll pick and choose among them and see if we can find some good answers.
Okay. Candace McCoy, in the summer of 1973, I was riveted to the black and white TV with the rabbit ears. I remember watching you folks, and I, political science major, into it. I remember Sam Ervin, and I remember what he was saying. If Sam Ervin were on that stage with you today, and he was thinking about what was happening today, what would he say?
He'd quote the Bible.
Hi, Wilfred from Brooklyn. My question has to do with, I guess it's a little ancillary, but what's going on in the White House at the time? Apparently, it came to light that there was a pact among high-level staffers and cabinet members to intervene or not authorize any sort of military action or up to nuclear strikes. There's, I think, some relevance to that today and in the grumblings in the news. What is the advisability, legality, and sort of efficacy of some sort of pact like that?
Well, I'm one who happens to believe that there should be a check on the president on his exercise of nuclear power. It's not there now. What happened during the Nixon presidency was James Schlesinger, the Secretary of Defense, said to everybody, call him if the president calls for the codes. Now, what he would have done, we don't know. It didn't happen. But he had instructed the military and the man who carried the codes that he was to get a hold of the Secretary of Defense before he responded to the president.
Or if the president called in the 101st Airborne to visit Capitol Hill or something
That's
like that.
True.
Last question, and you can say you're from the Brennan Center as well as from Brooklyn.
Doug from the Brennan Center in Brooklyn. So I'm curious about what good might come from our current situation, for lack of a better euphemism. Watergate led to some remarkable reforms, including the entire foundation of our campaign finance system.
Which didn't last very long.
So that's a fair point. So what created the will for that to happen? What needed to happen to get there? Can that happen now? Or are we in another era?
And if I can amplify that, what reforms short of impeachment can restore checks and balances, can restore the rule of law, can bolster the unwritten norms?
There were a number of post-Watergate reforms that were instant and short-lived. The change between relationship between the president and the media, and investigative journalism became the norm. It's now too expensive. While there are grants and efforts to do it, many in the media find that people don't even want those big digging articles that go deep into these subjects. That they want a soundbite or something they can read on a blog is just as satisfying to them. So investigative journalism came and went. But what did change permanently is the relationship between the president and the media. Presidents pre-Watergate were given the benefit of the doubt. Post-Watergate, they almost have to prove their innocence And the burden is on them to do so much more than it was pre-Watergate. The other thing is, of course, impeachment and the machinery has been oiled, and we know how the process worked. It was abused during the Clinton presidency when it was a straight partisan vote that sent the bill of impeachment to trial in the Senate. It was the political process, that being much more partisan than broadly political. But the reforms, the lasting reform, has been what happened to lawyers post-Watergate and the ethics requirements. When I went to law school, I had a 1/4 credit you took for ethics. I don't know about Harvard, but it was 1/4 credits. You know, don't lie, don't steal, don't cheat, but most of all, don't advertise. That was the big prohibition. A little bit on conflicts of interest, but not much. But that has dramatically changed. Today, they teach ethics in law school. The ABA came out with a very strong code, 80% of which was adopted post-Watergate. It went 100% post-Enron, the two of them combined. Today, there's a very strong model that's been adopted by virtually every state in totality. It's been adopted by every state, but not always in the totality. So I think probably the most lasting impact has been for the practice of law.
I would say that there are many things that could be done short of impeachment, but they require a system of checks and balances that will effectively work. We have, I mean, just to give you one small example, the Senate Intelligence Committee is looking at so-called Russian collusion. And they asked the various social media companies to report about the ads that were taken. And Senator Warner, whom I normally respect and like, and nice fellow, said to Twitter, because they turned up 100 tweets that were relevant, he said he was disappointed. Well, something wrong with this picture. There's something called the subpoena power in Congress. If you're serious about doing an investigation, you can issue a subpoena. So what kind of investigation is going on? There could have been serious and should be serious investigations about that. There should be serious investigation about the whole issue of money, emoluments, bribery. Emoluments kind of slinks right into bribery, which is a specific defined term in the Constitution.
Yeah, people forget.
Who's looking at that?
You did during Watergate. And people forget that that was one of the things that was examined under the impeachment effort to look at Nixon as to whether he had violated the Emoluments Clause.
Correct. We looked at that. But what's going on now? We have a situation. I mean, that was kind of Piker kind of thing. I mean, Nixon had some changes made in the in one of his was it San Clemente? Yeah, one of his houses to have some airport, some facility created or whatever. It was a small amount of money, relatively speaking. We're talking about tens of millions of dollars that are pouring into the Trump organization. The money is going into Mr. Trump's pockets. That theoretically could be bribery. Depends on how it's looked at, but nobody is looking at it. So, yes, could things be done? You bet. And that's where I think what John Dean said is really important. In Watergate, you had a very bad actor in the president, but everybody, the other institutions came and took his play and spoke up against him and worked to try to restore democracy. The press was one of it, the courts were part of it, and Congress was part of it. Here we have a very weak, insufficient Congress and the press. I think they're trying, but they don't have the resources, so it's a very far cry from what happened in Watergate.
There's a vertebrae problem with the Republican Party.
Yeah, well.
And that will be our last word. Okay. Thank you to both of you. This is really terrific. And thank you to everybody here for being part of this conversation. Amid this moment of crisis for our Constitution and our democracy, a lot of the obligation falls on all of us to hold these institutions accountable going forward. Thank you for being part of this, and thank you both.